Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. For nearly 50 years, the Iroquois chief Gaiasuta battled for the sovereignty and the future of his people. Beginning his career with a 21-year-old George Washington, Gaiasuta would eventually come to fight the young Virginian in a catastrophic alliance with the Empire of France. Instrumental next in the Indian Rebellion of 1763, Gaiasuta waged a war of terror and violence against British settlements before ultimately succumbing to European control. Although he served as a peace chief early in the American Revolution, his eventual siding with the British Empire appeared to doom his people. Spanning over 7 decades, Gaiasuta's life offers a front-row seat to the fall of Indian America. Remember, an all-new season of Wartime premieres February 28th. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Live. Let me start by saying what a privilege it is to be here with you this afternoon. I know on a Saturday there's a lot of things we could be doing, but the fact that we're here in pursuit of understanding our regional and national history a little better is something we should all be pretty proud of, and I'm glad I can share that with you. This is really, I think, an interesting opportunity for me because of not only the history we'll be talking about, but a little bit of the history of this building. You know, in the Pittsburgh Athletic Association, one of the great patrons in the history of Pittsburgh, Art Rooney, actually made a lot of deals in this very building. And to a degree, what we're going to be talking about is the art of the deal, how to make deals, how to broker deals, how to get the best for your side. And I think when we talk about a person like the Chief Gaiasuta, the subject of my latest book, making deals is what perhaps his greatest legacy could be. So I'd like to talk a little bit about his life, how it fits into not only the history of Western Pennsylvania, but the state of Ohio, West Virginia, New York, as well, and see if we can get to the root a little more of really the big question of history, which is, so what? Right? Why should we care? Gaiasuta, from the beginning of his life, always had the ambition to get the best deal, not only for himself, but for his people. And sometimes that meant making strange alliances, and sometimes that meant calling on enemies. In the first part of his life, he'll be an ally of the French. In the second part of his life, he'll be an ally of the British. And at the end of his life, he'll do everything possible to try and ally his people ineffectively with the United States of America. Really an incredible life. Gaiasuta is born in 1724. He's born in the Genesee River Valley of New York. And he's born into a world of relative privilege as far as we can be concerned. Gaiasuta's parents were Iroquois. Members of the powerful Iroquois Confederacy, and at a very young age, they moved him into what we call the Ohio Country, Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, in an effort to colonize the region in the name of what could ostensibly be called an empire, the Iroquois Empire. Well, we really lose track of Gaiasuta for most of the early part of his life, but we see him jump back into the historical record in about the year 1753. It's that same year he meets a 21-year-old ambitious Virginian named George Washington. So I think at least we have that one point of reference in what can be a very alien story for us, the story of the American Indian for most that don't understand it, to have a better sense of who they are. George Washington I use in my book sort of as a tentpole in a way to bring us back to a comfort zone we can feel more familiar with as we try and explore this world. But in 1753, Washington and Gaiasuta, and really the first time we see Gaiasuta in the historical record, meet along the Ohio River at a French-built village called Logstown. Logstown being the real center of the geopolitical struggle of the region. Now, at this point, Gaiasuta is really a man between two worlds. His ancestral roots are Iroquois. The Iroquois are firm allies of the British Empire. But his whole life, he's been raised amongst people that aren't Iroquois. He's been raised amongst people of the Ohio country, people who are Shawnee, people who are Delaware. He himself has taken on a new identity. He calls Mingo. Mingo being sort of an Iroquois transplant raised amongst a different group of people. Sort of the way the Americans are still British, yet American is a new identity they have. Mingo. So Gaiasud is a man between those two worlds. And the greater strategy of war in Europe is making him draw a line in the sand and make a decision. If he honors his parents and his grandparents' legacy, he'll join in the fight with the British. But if he's a practical man, he'll take advantage of everything that France is offering the people we've just mentioned, the Shawnee, the Delaware, the Mingo. You see, the French have a strategy for winning a larger war in North America against the British in 1753. And it's basically this. The French know the Iroquois are British allies. They'll never get them away from the British. But they also know they can't win a war without an Indian ally of some kind. So the French start to woo the subjects of the Iroquois, the people of the Ohio country, to their side. They need some Indian ally, and they're really sweetening the pot with weapons and ammunition and money and trade goods of all sorts. So Gaiasuta has to make a decision when he meets the young George Washington. Does he align himself with the British, or does he join in the rebellion with his new people, these peoples of the Ohio country, and join the French? He's always trying to get the best deal for himself and the best deal for his people. And he believes, in the end, the French will offer him that deal. It's when the Seven Years' War begins around the world, the French and Indian War here in North America, Gaiasuta is staring down the barrel of a gun shooting at British redcoats. Not because he loves France, but because the French offer the best opportunity for the success of his people. He's a young warrior, Gaiasuta. He's really not on the map yet as far as being any kind of real practical leader. I mean, he's very much a secondary figure. He's in his late 20s. But it's the experience of the Seven Years' War that's really going to propel him in the eyes of his people to being a very successful patron in that regard. From 1754 to 1763, Gaiasuta wages war, not just against the British to help the French. That's certainly the French ambition. But more importantly for him, for his people of the Ohio country. For him, it's a rebellion against the Iroquois that he owes his ancestral roots to. I like to say that the Ohio Indians are all in the French and Indian War, because they are in rebellion, much like the Americans will be 10 years later against the British Empire. The Ohio Indians are in rebellion against the Iroquois Empire. Well, when the French and Indian War ends, the French will lose, not to spoil the ending, and the history of North America is a British history. But because of that war, we have names like Duquesne as just part of our lexicon in America now. It's part of that story. But when the French abandon North America, we tend to move on. We tend to say, well, the war's over. The British have won the war. The history of North America will be a British one. But there's a problem. And it comes from a vantage point we don't take enough when we talk about these conflicts, which is the Indian viewpoint. In a lot of regards, the book I've written tells the story of colonial America from the Indian vantage point. And it's not a good story for them. It's one that ends in a very unfortunate way, but that's the story we're left with. Whenever the French leave after the French and Indian War, the British think they have a victory on their hands. But remember, there's a significant portion of the people who fought in that war. The Ohio Indians, the Shawnee, the Delaware, the Mingo, the people of the Ohio country, Gaiasuta's people, that are still fighting a war. They use the French alliance to help them win their freedom from the Iroquois. Well, their war is not over. Yet, the French allies have backed out because their war was. So again, when you take that viewpoint, it becomes a much more complicated and difficult story. At the end of 1763, I always like to say the American Revolutionary period really begins. Because the complaints, the grievances of the colonists, taxes being too high, spending being cut, all of that starts with an effort to pay off the French and Indian War. Before the French and Indian War, the British imperial debt was about 74 million pounds sterling. After, about 124 million pounds. So it didn't double, but it was a significant increase. And after over a decade of war today, we know that's a pretty expensive tab, not only in terms of financial investment for us, but human life. The British are faced with those same practical realities. They have a huge debt after the Seven Years' War. They have to pay for it, and they have to find a way how. Well, the option they take is twofold. One is raising revenue, raising taxes. This is where we get our, you know, the old no taxation without representation issue the Americans come up with. But the other part, which we almost never talk about, are the spending cuts. The British will significantly cut spending to help stop the bleeding from the Seven Years' War. Now, in their logic, they ask what colonists of the British Empire stood to gain the most. And what colonies cost the most to defend in this war? Well, every way you look at it, it's the American colonies. So the taxes go up on the Americans, and their spending goes down. The Americans believe they're happier to be British than ever before in 1763. They should be getting a great pat on the back. Instead, they get stuck with the bill, I like to say. So all of this goes into the beginnings of the Revolution, but never forget Guyasut and his Indian world. They're really left out of this. We know where the taxes come from in the American Revolution. Stamp Act, Sugar Act, towns and duties, tea parties, these sort of things. But we have to ask, what is the spending that's cut? And this is where Guyasut comes into the story. Part of the ways that at the beginning of the French and Indian War, that the French really tried to get the natives on their side was gift giving. The Indian economy is completely based on trade. The British had to keep up if they wanted to keep the Indians neutral. The natives played the French and British off each other like children of divorce in that regard. The French gave us this, what will you give us in return? And it worked really well. It got to the point after 50 years, the entire Indian economy was based on trade from the Europeans. But when the French leave, they're out. They're gone in North America. And that means the Indians lose half of their wealth, half of their trade goods. But when the British are looking at how they can save money, they say, why are we still giving gifts to the Indians? We only did it to compete with the French, and the French are gone. Well, after a while, that's cut too. And what we see occur in 1763, as a result of the British trying to save money from the war, pay off their debt, the Indian economy in North America falls out. It collapses. And we know what tough economic times looks like. Men become desperate. They turn to alcoholism. They turn to drugs. People really start to lose faith in themselves. They feel like they have no future. It's an economic depression. Church attendance during economic depression tends to go up. Well, at this time in the Indian world, we're seeing the same things happen. A spiritual leader, he's a Delaware, named Neolin, comes on the scene. And he tells people, we can regain our pride as Indian peoples in this tough economic time. But we have to expel white ways. No more dressing like the whites. No more using white weapons. We need to go back to our Indian roots. And Neolin has a religious message. It sort of takes hold during the time. The tough economic time helps. But then a guy named Pontiac comes along. And Pontiac will say, well, when Neolin was preaching that, he's really talking about violence. Pontiac says we should force the whites off of North America. And what we see is what we call Pontiac's Rebellion in 1763. But Guyasut plays an interesting role in this, because Pontiac was a Great Lakes Indian. He had really no interest in this area. The person that really stirred on Neolin's message into a political form here was Guyasut. I love driving through Pittsburgh. There are no less that I've counted than four enormous statues and paintings of Guyasut, but no one can almost tell you at all what he did. And I think that's hopefully a lot of this book is sort of just spreading awareness. Guyasut will lead a political rebellion here in the Ohio country, and it's an incredibly violent rebellion. And it is simply to push the British off of what he considers to be Indian land. In my research, I found some pretty interesting stories that were largely lost to most people. One is that in 1761, 2 years before Pontiac's rebellion, as we call it, took place, Guyasut went to the Great Lakes, and he held councils, and he said, the French are going to lose. The British are going to cut us off, just like the French will, and we're going to be in big trouble. But nobody listened to Guyasut at the time in 1761 because times were still good. The trade goods were still flowing. Well, sure enough, 2 years later, Pontiac has the same message. And this time the natives have seen Guyasut was actually prophetic in that regard. He does not get enough credit for his role in that Indian rebellion. Again, a whole chapter dedicated to that. But the war Guyasut rages in the Ohio country is a brutal one. It's a violent one. It's a terrible one. In a lot of ways, even though we view the Pontiac's rebellion or Guyasut's rebellion as an aftermath of the 7 Years' War, it's really still a part of it. Because the Indians are still fighting redcoats, as they were the entire French and Indian War. Because again, that war was never about France for them. France was just their means of success. To them, it's fighting for their own rights. Well, in 1763, we see a siege of Fort Pitt, really the most substantial action Fort Pitt has ever seen. And we see the native peoples eventually fizzle out. The rebellion loses. The Battle of Bushy Run occurs in 1763, which I really think is the end of that original rebellion, what I call the Ohioan Rebellion, the death of that new Ohioan who's trying to separate from the Iroquois. Bushy Run is a major battle in terms of its role in really crushing the Indian identity in a lot of ways. But we view it as a very minor footnote in our history. Fortunately for us, it's about a 40-minute drive from here with traffic, so it's very close by. But Gaius Suta has used the French as an avenue to success. And the French have given up. They've lost. So now again, what he has to do is make the best deal for his people, and that might be making allies with an old enemy. Gaius Suta is always, I think, a forward thinker. I love creative solutions myself. Gaius Suta offers a lot. But he sees, rather than keeping up this war against the British, we're never going to win, he sees, why don't we just work with them? You know, who would have thought of that? Work together for a better world. Well, Gaius Suta does that. He makes alliances with the British in the wake of the French and Indian War because he realizes they're here to stay and there is a role for the Indian in this world. He becomes a guide. He becomes sort of a scout in a lot of ways. He really is a go-to guy for the British Empire at the time. We have a statue in Pittsburgh of George Washington and Gaius Suta face-to-face on top of Mount Washington. Have you guys ever seen this? It's a beautiful statue, very well done. And it's basically highlighting an event that happened in 1770. Whenever George Washington, still very British, and looking to make a pretty substantial investment in land along the Ohio River, is traveling down the Ohio River and he meets, of all people, Gaius Suta. And they talk because they remember each other from 1753. Now this story is really interesting in a lot of ways because it kind of shows Washington's life and Gaius Suta's life paralleling each other. But then eventually they just split. And obviously one has a large amount of success and one, like his Indian world, goes down pretty hard. But they meet in 1770, they spend an evening together, they're eating buffalo, they tell stories, they share stories, and they move on. George Washington, by all accounts from his journal, probably had no idea that Gaius Suta was actually shooting at him for most of the last 7 years. But at any rate, and they literally were at the Battle of the Monongahela, Braddock's defeat, Gaius Suta and Washington were on opposing sides of the same battle. So maybe they were shooting at each other, but he didn't know it at the time. But Gaius Suta understands the best deal is working with the British. And he has a very healthy and robust life. He makes a nice career for the next 10 years. But then right around 1775 and 1776, a little problem really heats up, at least for the British. We call it the American Revolution. And Gaius Suta again has to make a decision. There's going to be a war. The Indians are going to play a role in this. What side do we take? Initially, for the first part of the war, Gaius Suta plays it safe. He plays it neutral. He goes to the Patriot base of Fort Pitt and the Royal base, we can say, of Fort Niagara in Youngstown, New York. And he goes back and forth, talking to each diplomat along the way. The Continental Congress, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, we know them, right? Declaration of Independence. They thought Gaius Suta was so important in the early part of the Revolution to keeping the Indians neutral in this area. They actually gave him a gorget. It's sort of a silver medallion. And a commission as a colonel in the American Continental Army. Gaius Suta. If you look at their ledgers, their meeting of minutes, yeah, the Declaration of Independence is on there, but so is a vote unanimous to make Gaius Suta a colonel in the Continental Army. It's an amazing story. That's the same group in Philadelphia that's so famous. But Gaius Suta will eventually side with the British, and open warfare will occur, and he forces the rest of his people to make a decision. Now, the American Revolution is very difficult for a lot of different people and a lot of different reasons. We learn more and more about this every day. But in the Iroquois world, it really ends the Iroquois Empire. It splits them up, makes it a civil war amongst themselves. But for the second time, and again, not to ruin the ending, the British will lose that. Gaius Suta goes all in for one side of a war, and he comes out at the wrong end of it. He sided with the French. It worked for him for a while, but ultimately they lost. He sided with the British in the Revolution. They lost as well. By the time we see the end of Gaius Suta's life, about 1795, George Washington is president. Gaius Suta, about the same age as Washington, that's why it's so interesting, is in a very different place. Washington has risen to heights even he himself probably never anticipated. Gaius Suta is a broken-down drunk who lives about 4 miles north of Pittsburgh. He wanders into the city to get liquor. He's broken down. He has years of war. People in the city know who he is. They say, why do we welcome this Gaius Suta, king of the Seneca, they call him. Hero of Bushy Run, they'll say things like that. Facetiously, to talk about the past where he's been such a problem for colonists. But in the last part of Gaius Suta's life, America's beginning its first war, the United States, and its first war is against a Northwest Indian Confederacy in the Ohio country. The Ohio Indians are still fighting that rebellion for carving out a name for themselves against the Americans. Gaius Suta, in his 70s, spends the final days of his life going from village to village telling them, don't fight this fight. You can't win. He sees men that were just like him in 1750 at the beginning of the French and Indian War. Men who think they can make a difference. Men who think fighting is actually a feasible option and a feasible route to success. And he's telling them throughout his life, you can't do it. Okay? Now, Gaius Suta will die in 1794, 1795. But by all accounts, he does live just long enough to see the Indian Confederacy crushed by the American army at the Battle of Fallen Timbers. And after that, the Treaty of Greenville, which pushes all native peoples forcibly out of this area to the other side of what would today be the state of Illinois, forces them away. For the first time, you can actually settle this area without a fear of Indian reprisal. The Treaty of Greenville causes a massive refugee crisis. But that's the world Gaius Suta sees in his final days. Now we look at Washington. He sees the birth of a new nation, the first democratic republic in modern history. He sees a world of possibility. Gaius Suta, in his final days, sees his world gone, eliminated, and really left in ashes in a lot of ways. So I think Gaius Suta is a great opportunity for us to not only study the native world, but the colonial American world. Because colonial America is much more than powdered wigs and coats and horses and, you know, fiddles and things. It's a very delicate, very diverse, very difficult and dangerous place in many cases. But I think when you factor in the Indian story to the greater story, the greater narrative we all know so well, you get a much different perspective on it, and a vital one at that. Thank you. I always say that, you know, this first part was, you know, a lot of hot air, but the questions are always the best part, because we're all historians, we're all here for the same reason. So, questions, discussions, anything, do we have some time? I don't know. Yeah. Gaius Suta would have had a lot of very pronounced figures in his life early on. But again, he was on the cusp of a new social movement, this sort of rebellion against the Iroquois. So earliest in his life that we know, whenever he marches with Washington in 1753 to Fort Leboeuf, he's marching with Tanit Cherison, he's marching with Jessakake, who's sort of a native Iroquois chief. He's very much sort of a secondary figure in that regard. But these are old Iroquois guys. They're old Iroquois power guys. But they live in this area amongst people who aren't Iroquois, who are under Iroquois control, and they see that these people are starting to rebel against them. So Gaius Suta had that mentor, but when it came for this new sort of rebellion, he was kind of the first line of that. Yeah. Did he ever meet Joseph Brandt, or was he just too young? Well, they're sort of a generation apart. In the American Revolution, Brandt is a major player. Gaius Suta is in his 50s. He's fighting as well. So they would have crossed paths, I'm sure. We have no historical record of it. But, you know, just because of the nature of that war and the fact that Fort Niagara was a place where all the native people sided with the British would have sort of come together, I have no doubt they probably would have crossed paths. He's a critical part, Joseph Brandt, of this story as well. So whether or not Brandt would have recognized Gaius Suta on a personal level, it's probably impossible to say.
What prompted your interest in
Gaius Suta? That's a very good question. I always say people come to history two ways. One is you hit a certain point in your life when you begin to appreciate it more. Generally, it's probably too late. And the other is you have a great teacher. And I had a really great teacher named David Dixon. And David Dixon was really, you know, one of the foremost thinkers in this field, sort of colonial frontier studies. And Gaius Suta was a guy that I always was interested in because I see his name a lot, but you could find almost nothing on him in the way people write books today. And I sort of sat down, Gaius Suta is my third book. I've said, this guy has been in every chapter I've ever written of every book. I think it's time that he gets his own limelight. I kind of kept a little folder of Gaius Suta references because there aren't many, but there is enough to craft a real story. So he's always been an interesting figure. And there is sort of a Pittsburgh tie to him, but he was much bigger than just Pittsburgh. Really the whole frontier was Gaius Suta's realm. But I would say that's probably where it came from. You just can't, when you study this field, he's everywhere, you know. So. Yeah. Cornstalk. With Cornstalk, you're talking about his real heyday is just before the American Revolution, 1774. In 1774, there was an event very hard to place if you don't think about the Indian world, called Lord Dunmore's War. And Pittsburgh played a major role in that. But Lord Dunmore's War is basically, it's chapter 7 of the Gaius Suta book. Gaius Suta is at the point where he's not fighting it, but he is a chief sort of diplomat for the British. So the British are telling him, go into what is today West Virginia, the Shawnee territory, calm them down, because it's sort of the result of the peace of the Seven Years' War. I always like to say the British won the war against the French, but they lost the peace afterwards. The Shawnee will rebel. There's a massive battle at Point Pleasant. Gaius Suda, really, his role was trying to calm the Shawnee down. He was kind of acting on behalf of the British. You know, they couldn't win the war. There's no effect for them to win. In that regard, Cornstalk and Gaius Suda may have met again. We have no record because the Indian record is very sparse. But his role in that was sort of as a pacifier, trying to keep the Shawnee away from war, which they didn't. And as a result, they were crushed pretty bad by the Virginians. Mm-hmm. Aliquippa is the only place she fits in. And I actually end my book on Washington 1753 mission with her. She was a powerful Iroquois leader, very much though, in her last year, in 1753. So when George Washington, in his very first mission, goes to Fort Lebeuf, he has to meet prominent Iroquois along the way to shore up British support. Aliquippa is an essential stop where he has to meet. He meets with her, he speaks with her. It's really one of the only times she's in the historical record, and she'll probably be dead that year, within that year. But that's where she plays in. She represents, she would be to Gaius Suta one of the elders of the Iroquois War. Gaius Suta, though, was on the verge of his own revolution against them. So that's where she would fit in. Do you have another question?
Mm-hmm. Where are the other three statues?
There's one, of course, the big one, the newest one, 2006 on Mount Washington, overlooking the city. There's a large painting of his face in a mural when you're walking down to the Good Ship Lollipop. What do you call that?
Gateway
Clipper. Yeah, there's big. His face is right there. It's real big. I mean, it's like the size. It's like, you know, 15 feet tall. It's huge. Station Square. Yeah, that's where it is. There's another one on the north side. It used to be on one of the bridges that went across the Allegheny. Now they have it on a park. It's built into a fence. There's another picture of him there. And the fourth one, and it's my favorite, is in Sharpsburg. Where he would have kept his home. It's a very large, it's a young guy, he's sort of striking a warrior pose. It stands on a big platform. Again, Sharpsburg is like Gaius Suta, ground zero, but almost no one knows anything about him other than the name. They celebrate him, and it's sort of like you're celebrating a guy that, you know, fought a lot of, you know, your ancestors for, you know. So, but yeah, those are the four. And there might be other ones, but those are the four I've encountered, the most prominent ones, but very large representations of him for a person that not enough people really know about. But I would say necessary, yeah.
And Chief Cornplanter from
Salamanca,
that was his nephew?
Cornplanter was Gaius Suta's nephew. The lineage is hard to trace because of the way the Iroquois keep, you know, we don't have any records from them, but whenever Gaius Suta dies, he'll be on the land Cornplanter was left by the U.S. government when they were making peace in that first Northwest Indian War against the British in 1790s. Yeah, so Gaius Suta will die there. That would be his nephew.
Where was he buried,
Gaius Suta? There's some debate about this, which, again, who sits around and talks about this but us, right? Some people want to say Gaius Suta is buried on the O'Hara Plantation in near Sharpsburg. But I really don't, I'm really not a big believer in that. There's no way of proving it. But it's more likely he would have been buried on Cornplanter's Grant in north central western PA. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of us right now. So I would say he's probably up there. But there's no way of proving it. So I do take that stance in the book, though.
How old was he when he died?
He's 1724. He's about 70, maybe 71. But it was a lot of miles on him, I like to say, for 71.
Did he have a family?
Yeah, even when he lived in Sharpsburg. What would become Sharpsburg? He had a small plantation or camp. He lived with multiple wives, young wives in their 20s, lots of children. One of the sparse records we have of him in 1761, and again, that's while the French and Indian War is still going on. A lot of Indians think the French will actually be around. He knows they won't. He sends one of his sons to Philadelphia for 2 years to learn English because he knows that's your ticket in the future. The British are going to win. So we know he has children. We know he has two wives. The record is very sparse in between, though, for his personal life, because he keeps no journals. I always envy people who, like, have these dozens and dozens of journals writing a biography, because, I mean, that could be 10,000 pages long. You should see the amount of, the only material we have of Gaius Suta are first-hand accounts from white people who meet him, and they don't understand the Indian world. So we have to sort of translate what's going on with our modern understanding of it and sort of decipher what they're trying to talk about. So we have nothing firsthand from Gaius Suta for the most part, except what other people relay. I envy those people who have, you know, mountains of documents to go with their actual words and to go through.
Were you able to find some of this documentation for people that wrote about the Vaisuda, or what did you use as your
sure? Well, it varies from place to place. George Washington kept a journal in 1753. He talks a lot about Gaiasutta in that, but he doesn't know his name. He just calls him the Hunter. But we know that because he's a young man, he's not taking the lead in that regard. There's older Iroquois chiefs to do that. As you go further in life, the British Empire's chief Indian sort of liaison in North America was named Sir William Johnson, and he lived in central New York. Gaiasutta and Johnson were together a lot, so Johnson's articles, Johnson's papers, mention him a great deal. That would be the majority of the first-hand information we have, because, you know, it's such a difficult story without the written word there. In the Pennsylvania colonial meeting of minutes, they talked about Gaiasutta's son being there, learning the English. And the other thing is, there is no Indian written language. So what we basically have are Americans and Brits trying to sound out the name. So he's called Gaiasutta. That's the one I take because I think it's the most common. Some call him Kayasutha, Kayashoto, Gaiasutta. I mean, imagine trying to find all that. And you're trying to make sense of it. I think I navigated it pretty well. I use Gaiasutta because I think it's the most sort of popular version, but probably something like Kayasutha might have been a little closer. There's no way of really knowing for sure, but so it was tough. It was a real challenge for the historian, right, to kind of sift through secondhand accounts of a first person story, I guess is the way you say it. Yeah.
Are there any accounts of any indigenous people themselves mentioning him? Because I think it's interesting when you look at some of the accounts, or supposed accounts, mm-hmm. of Indians talking about Indians from New Wonderland, their accounts are so much different than what we have in our white records.
The oral history is the key for the early Indian world. And I like the 1750s and 1760s. That's the primary field I study. Because this is not first contact. This is not Columbus getting off of a boat, you know, and seeing Indians for the first time. The Indian world and the British world and the French world have kind of all fused together on the frontier and made their own unique culture. So you have a lot of Indians who are writing for the first time in an English or French way. You have a lot of first-hand accounts from them. I'm trying to think offhand if Gaiasutta is ever mentioned by an Indian specifically. We do have some accounts from some of the councils at Fort Pitt that mention he's in attendance. Whenever he, in 1761, when he first tried to sort of tell the Great Lakes people, the French are going to leave you and you're going to have to be ready for that, there are some first-hand accounts there. William Johnson actually travels to 1761 to the Great Lakes to try and figure out who's the Indian causing all the trouble. Because the real rebellion will happen for two more years. And one of the people there, one of the chiefs says, there is a bad bird amongst us, and he is Gaiasutta. He literally tells them, and Gaiasutta's like, come on, you know, this is, you're gonna stab me in the back like this. So, it's limited at best, I would say. I guess that's the best way to say it. And who knows what else, yeah, again, we don't have the written accounts from most of them, so who knows what we're missing. As far as oral tradition, though, I found them to be a little less reliable at that time because you are seeing the written language kind of take hold from Europeans. Not as it would be in previous times. It would be much more reliable. And it was a war, too, which is a whole different thing.
Okay. Yeah. Happened to possibly use the Draper
I haven't gone through them. No, I haven't gone through them. This story's not exactly a biography, you know. When I think of a biography, I think of like a big, you know, 800-page book. Because there's biographies on, you know, people like presidents, people like Walt Disney, for example. I want to just read Art Rooney. These are massive books because we have people who still remember it. We have many different accounts. This is really much more sort of using Gaiasutta as a lens to understand the world around him. You know, we talk about the major benchmarks in what I call the fall of Indian America from 1753 to 1795. By 1795, the world's not recognizable for Gaiasutta. So if you only, you know, followed his life, you'd miss a much bigger story, I guess. So it's not a traditional biography. I always wanted to do a traditional biography where I take, you know, 10 years or whatever and find every single detail and bore myself with the minutiae of it. But this is much more. So what I'm saying is, I guess if there were the deep sort of manuscript cuts, I don't know how much it would have changed what I was trying to do. So it wasn't effective to go through all of that, I guess is what I'm trying to say, yeah. I found everything that I could. I'm not trying to say I skimped on it anyway, but that's what I would say, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't.
And I don't know that they would know. They would, typically I would say, you know, Western New York is still the large Seneca reservation, so they would probably be there. He never had any, you know, what we would think of as mixed race children. He always had Indian wives. But I've never encountered anything like that. I have encountered other people's, but not Guy Suda necessarily. I think he's such a fascinating person. I always try and tell my students there is no Indian written language. There's no written word. And they think that it indicates like a lack of intelligence, but it's just a wholly different linguistic tradition. I mean, separated by an ocean. Guy Suda not only spoke English and French, but he probably spoke about 30 different Indian dialects. I mean, this is a bright guy. You have to be. And it's just the nature of where you live and what he has to do as a diplomat. A lot of language, but definitely English and French. And a lot of the times, the English didn't speak French, and the French didn't speak English, and here are the Indians speaking all, you know, all the same. That's what you find more often than not. Yes?
What's the title of your next book?
One of the things I like to do, and this isn't signed yet, but whatever. One of the things I really like to do is take, like, the American Revolution story we all know really well. There's a lot of different layers to it, and a lot of different characters that we just haven't hashed out. And I look for groups like that. The Indians, in that regard, is one of them. But we're getting better as a community, I think. But there's one group of people that we sort of know they're there. We give them a certain role, we write them off, or we fit them into the narrative. But I think the Hessians from Germany in the American Revolution, I'm going through a lot of primary sources and documents and journals from these guys. It is mind-blowing, the journeys they go through. So that's what my next project I'd like it to be, is the only first detailed study of the Hessians we've ever had. I mean, these are guys that we always call them like mercenaries. They're not paid really anything. The money goes directly to whoever their king is, and he just ships them as his army. So they don't make any money off of that, and they're here fighting. There's one instance in Hesse Castle. The king gets a ledger of how many of his soldiers were killed fighting in America, and he's upset because more didn't die. Because he's actually paid when soldiers die. Like, sorry for your loss. So he's mad more soldiers don't die because that's more money for him. I mean, these guys are really given a negative spin because I think it suits a sort of a story better. But these are, and some of them go home and some of them stay. Some of them like the opportunity of America. Some of them go back. It's endlessly fascinating to me. So that's what I'm working on now. And I'm about 10% through it, but it's just so early. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What I'd like to do with it is, and again, it's all very early, and editors have a lot to do with this. I'm telling three different stories, three different guys' experiences, three different soldiers. One is a very high-ranking Hessian officer. His records are very detailed. I mean, these guys are writing, you know, a lot, books worth of journals. He's very straightforward and very strict. I'm doing one who is just sort of a low-level soldier who fights and comes back, and the other is a minister, you know, with his men, and he stays behind and settles. So I'm going to do all three.
Mm-hmm. And she was here during the battles.
A Hessian woman, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I picked these three. There's a whole, but there's a lot of them. I picked these three because, one, they're fully translated, which I don't speak German well enough to do that. And two, because I think they give a good sample of the larger story. You get three very different outcomes from it. But very different than what we commonly think about the Hessians. So, but again, that's at least 3 years out, I would say. I mean, it's very early. I'm pretty excited about it, but when you're used to Indian sources and you actually get actual accounts, you feel like that's a gold mine or something, I guess. Yeah. Well, obviously, we're all very historically minded people, so I look forward to meeting you and hearing about some of your research and what you're working on and, you know, talking. And if you'd like to buy books, of course, we're over here doing that. And I'll, you know, any of that, it's been great. Thank you very much.